We'll turn again, please, to the second passage we read just now, Luke's Gospel, chapter 20, and verses 20 to 26. Now, our present spell in Luke's Gospel may seem to be going on forever, but it is my plan to just go up to the end of chapter 21, which shouldn't take us too long now, and then at that point we shall take a break and move on for a while to something else. But here in chapter 20, the religious leaders in Jerusalem are absolutely desperate now to have Jesus killed. They're absolutely desperate now to have Jesus removed from the scene altogether. But they're faced with three problems. Problem number one, if they themselves illegally execute Jesus, then that is inevitably going to cause a public outrage, because of course Jesus is still attracting large crowds with his public teaching, and these crowds of people who are swarming to listen to Jesus, they aren't going to take kindly to that kind of draconian intervention by the religious leaders. That's problem number one. Problem number two, the only way in which Jesus can be legally executed is at the command of the Roman governor. And the Roman governor isn't going to authorize an execution lightly. He isn't going to do so on the basis that Jesus has said something against the law of Moses, or on the basis that Jesus has broken the Sabbath. He isn't going to be interested in those kinds of charges. Only if they can get Jesus to say something treasonable. Only if they can get Jesus to say something anti-imperial. Only if they can get Jesus to say something subversive to the Roman occupation. Only then is the Roman governor going to take them seriously. And then problem number three. If they go up to Jesus with their notebooks and their pens, and they say, come on, Jesus, tell us what you think about the Romans. Tell us what you think about Caesar. Tell us what you think about Pontius Pilate. Well, the relationship by now is so strained between Jesus and these religious leaders that he's going to smell a rat immediately. He's going to immediately work out exactly what they're up to, that they're trying to set him up. And so those then are the three problems that these religious leaders face. But these religious leaders are determined people, and they are resourceful people, so they come up with a cunning plan. What they'll do is they will send some spies, some representatives to Jesus, ordinary looking men who will just blend into the crowd, attracting no suspicion whatsoever. And these spies will then ask Jesus a question, not a crass question like, what do you think of the Romans? But a much more subtle question like, what do you think about paying taxes to the Romans? And in that disarming context, the religious leaders were sure Jesus would put his foot in it. Jesus would say something incriminating. Jesus would sound off about what an obscenity it is, God's covenant people filling the coffers of this vile pagan regime. And then that would be enough. They would have their pretext to whisk him away to the Roman governor. Pontius Pilate, this man Jesus is seditious. He's a dangerous Jewish nationalist. He's inciting hatred and rebellion against the empire. You're going to have to deal with him. You're going to have to remove him from the scene. So that's their cunning plan. And sure enough, they implement it. They send these spies to Jesus, and the spies ask their question. But it doesn't quite turn out as the religious leaders had expected, because the response which Jesus gives to the spies' question in verses 24 and 25 is not the response which the religious leaders were anticipating. And so I just want us to spend a few minutes reflecting on Jesus' response. And I want to suggest that Jesus' response here demonstrates four things. First of all, this morning, it demonstrates brilliant rhetoric. Brilliant rhetoric. That's the first thing that it demonstrates. Because that phrase, there in verse 25 is exquisite, isn't it? Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. It's so pithy, it's so concise, it's so memorable. Like, let there be light, and an eye for an eye, and turn the other cheek. It's one of those lines which you still hear quoted today by politicians and journalists and others, even in such a biblically illiterate age. It's an exquisite answer that Jesus comes out with. But it raises the question, why? Why does Jesus express himself so ornately here? Some of you may sometimes listen to the football on Radio 5 on a Saturday afternoon. And if so, then you'll be familiar with Stuart Hall's match reports. And whereas most football journalists then just resort to tired old cliches about how Rooney was heading for an early bath and Sir Alex was sick as a parrot and all that kind of stuff, Stuart Hall takes a much more cultured approach. He quotes from Shakespeare, he throws in bits of Latin, he uses sophisticated wordplay. He somehow manages to inject a touch of elegance into the most mind-numbing goalless draw between Hull City and Wigan Athletic. And the question I'm asking is this: as we see Jesus here exhibiting such oratorical flair in this response to the spies, is he simply doing a Stuart Hall? Is he simply being a bit quirky and a bit entertaining and a bit eccentric? After all, a simple yes would have done the job. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Yes, it is. That would have done the job. And when, therefore, instead, as I say, he exhibits such oratorical flair, is he doing a bit of a Stuart Hall? Well, I think the answer is no. I think there's much more to it than that. I think that Jesus here is laying down a principle. I think, in fact, that it's part of Jesus' majesty here. That even as these religious leaders are pulling out all the stops to catch their prey, all these spies and all these cleverly loaded questions and all the rest of it, Jesus is so far from being fazed by the whole thing, he's so far from being panicked by the whole thing, that he even uses the opportunity, he uses the situation to lay down a principle here for his people in all the centuries and millennia to come. Because you see, Jesus is aware that a major transition, a seismic shift, is about to take place. So that from now on, the people of God will no longer be identified with one nation. One nation whose constitution is the law of God delivered at Sinai. For centuries, that had been the case. For centuries, the people of God had been identified with the nation of Israel. But from now on, that was no longer going to be the case. From now on, the people of God was going to be multinational. From now on, it would include members from all kinds of nations with all kinds of constitutions and all kinds of rulers and governments and political arrangements. And Jesus is aware that this new situation would throw up unprecedented challenges and tensions and dilemmas for his people. And that amidst those challenges and tensions and dilemmas, they would need a principle, a clear and basic principle which they could apply. And this then is Jesus articulating that principle. And that's why then he speaks so memorably here. He speaks so memorably because he wants it to be remembered. Jesus here is preparing his people for a new era in which pagan Caesars, pagan governments will be the norm, will be an unavoidable fact of life. And he wants his words, therefore, to lodge in their minds. He wants his words to stick with them. Had he just given a one-word answer, had he just said, yes, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? Yes. Then that would have been enough to silence the religious leaders who were hoping he would say no. It would have been enough. But that answer would not have rung in the ears of Jesus' people throughout the ensuing centuries. Jesus' people in first century Asia Minor, living under Emperor Nero. Jesus' people in 20th century China, living under a communist regime. Jesus' people in 21st century Britain, living under a coalition government. And I'm saying then that Jesus here uses this brilliant rhetoric because he's thinking beyond this little dialogue with these insignificant spies. He's laying down a principle. He's saying something that is going to be of particular relevance to the people of God in this new multinational era that they are about to enter into. A new phase of God's redemptive plan is about to dawn. A phase where the nations would flood into the kingdom of God. A phase, therefore, in which God's people would be living under Caesars, under governments, under rulers who weren't God's people. And so Jesus here is taking this opportunity to memorably and strikingly and arrestingly lay down a principle for his people in that new era, right up until the end of time. So that's the first thing that Jesus' response demonstrates. It demonstrates brilliant rhetoric. But then secondly, it demonstrates brilliant balance. Brilliant balance. And I'm referring here actually just to the first half of Jesus' response, to the give to Caesar what is Caesar's bit. Because it seems to me that even that little clause itself demonstrates a beautiful balance. Because on the one hand, you see, Jesus is saying, give to Caesar. Give to Caesar. Now, for some people in this crowd listening to Jesus, that would have been anathema. Give to Caesar? You mean acknowledge that that godless, immoral, unprincipled emperor has rights and prerogatives which we should recognize and take seriously? Is that not the very definition of compromise and worldliness? Is that not the betrayal of everything that it means to be the holy people of God in this world? Some members of Jesus' audience here would have been absolutely scandalized by those three words, give to Caesar. But that's what Jesus is saying. He's saying that God's people are to live in their societies as responsible citizens, giving to the state, regardless of the moral stance, regardless of the religious stance of that state. At a most basic level, God's people are to give money to the state through taxation, and that is the particular issue, of course, which Jesus is addressing here. But the Apostle Paul will later develop this teaching. And as we read earlier on in Romans chapter 13, he will insist that God's people are also to give respect to the states. And they're also to give honor to the states. And then in that other passage that we referred to in our prayer, in 1 Timothy 2 verses 1 and 2, he will insist there that God's people are to give prayerful consideration to the state. And I'm saying then that there's this utterly inescapable strand of New Testament teaching which insists with absolute clarity that the people of God have obligations to the state, regardless, as I say, of the religious stance, regardless of the moral tone of that state. And this is challenging for us, and we're going to return to it in a couple of minutes. But that is the clear teaching of this strand of the New Testament, that God's people have obligations to the state. So on the one hand, that's one side of the balance, Jesus saying, give to Caesar. But then on the other hand, Jesus is also saying, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. In other words, Jesus isn't saying, give to Caesar without limits. He isn't saying, give anything and everything to Caesar. He's implying, in fact, that it's possible to take Caesar too seriously and to give more to Caesar than is warranted. And this would have been particularly pertinent, I think, for those very religious leaders who were trying at this point to get their hands on Jesus. Because why were they trying to get their hands on Jesus? Why was it that these religious leaders so desperately wanted to get rid of Jesus? Well, there are probably different answers that we could give to that question, but one of the clearest biblical answers to that question is to be found in John chapter 11. In John chapter 11, verses 47 to 50, we're given this little window into a meeting of the Jewish Sanhedrin, that is, the Jewish ruling council. A meeting at which the one and only item on the agenda seems to be, what on earth are we going to do about Jesus? And in verse 48 of John 11, the Jesus problem then is framed in this way. They say, if we let him go on like this, and by the way, Jesus, remember, has just raised a man from the dead here. So when they say, if we let him go on like this, they mean, if we let him go on, defying the laws of nature and carrying out the most extraordinarily mind-boggling phenomena, like raising people from the dead. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. And so it is that then Caiaphas, the high priest, speaks up in verse 49, "You know nothing at all." He's obviously not a man given to great tact and diplomacy. "You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish." In other words, then, here are these religious leaders of the Jews. And the evidence of Jesus' messianic identity is staring them in the face. They've just seen Jesus raise a man who has been dead and buried for several days. The evidence is staring them in the face, and they're not denying that evidence. They're not trying to explain away what has just happened in Bethany with Lazarus. They're not trying to say, oh, that was just a conjuring trick. They know very well that Jesus has just done something that nobody else except God's Messiah could do. Why then don't they bow the knee to him? Why don't they follow him and become his disciples? Well, the answer is that those religious leaders don't actually want a Messiah. For them, at that particular point, the emergence of a Messiah on the scene would be jolly inconvenient. Why? Because it might upset the Romans. It might ruffle Caesar's feathers, and that might have all kinds of messy and unpleasant and undesirable consequences. And do you see what I'm saying then? I'm saying that these religious leaders, they were guilty of giving too much to Caesar. They were giving too much respect, too much significance, too much loyalty to Caesar. They were too much in awe of the Roman Empire. And that was actually taking precedence over their response to God's anointed king, Jesus. If you read much church history, then you'll soon discover that throughout the centuries, throughout the last two millennia, many Christian people have been imprisoned and indeed have been executed for fighting against the giving of too much to the state. These people saw that the state was demanding a compliance from the church which the state had no right to demand from the church. One of the most famous utterances in Scottish church history is that of a man called Andrew Melville in the late 16th century. And on one occasion, he found himself face to face with King James VI of Scotland. And he was one such ruler who was demanding a compliance from the church, which he had no right to demand from the church in Andrew Melville's view. And Andrew Melville said these famous words to him. He said, "Sir, there are two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. There is King James, the head of the Commonwealth, and there is Christ Jesus, the King of the Church, whose subject James VI is, and of whose kingdom he is not a king, nor a head, nor a lord, but a member. And we ourselves may soon find ourselves in a situation where this is becoming increasingly relevant. We ourselves may find ourselves in a situation where the state is demanding from the church a compliance which it has no right to demand, a compliance in the employment of practicing homosexuals, a compliance in the non-proselytization of unbelievers, a compliance in all kinds of things which we cannot comply with because it goes against the legislation and the instruction of our King Jesus in his word. And when those days come, we need to be ready to say, we give to Caesar, yes, we give to Caesar taxes, we give to Caesar respect, we give to Caesar honor, but we give to Caesar only what is Caesar's. And Caesar does not have the right to demand compliance from us in areas which would violate the laws of our King Jesus. And that will, of course, bring a cost, as it did for so many people in church history. But we need to be ready to insist upon that. And I'm saying then that there's brilliant balance here. Give to Caesar. Jesus is saying that very clearly. And Paul will later develop that so astonishingly there in Romans 13. But give to Caesar what is Caesar's. And don't give to him that which our King Jesus would not allow us to give to him. So this response, it demonstrates brilliant rhetoric, it demonstrates brilliant balance, but then thirdly, it demonstrates brilliant drama. Brilliant drama. And I'm talking then about this whole denarius business there in verse 24. And the fact then that in that verse, Jesus doesn't simply allude to a denarius, he doesn't simply mention a denarius as an example of what he's saying, but he actually requests a denarius. Show me a denarius, he says. He actually physically picks one up and holds it up before the crowd. And you just kind of think, what's he playing at here? What's he doing? Surely a serious religious teacher like Jesus shouldn't be resorting to this kind of drama, this kind of gimmickry, this kind of visual aid. What is Jesus doing here, getting this denarius and holding it up before the crowd? In the last few days, Jeremy Dibble, professor of music at Durham University, has been quoted in the newspapers lambasting the recent national disgrace. And you might be wondering what England's exit from the World Cup has got to do with a professor of music at Durham University. But that's not the national disgrace he's been lambasting. It's rather the removal of the picture of Sir Edward Elgar from our £20 note. That, he says, is a national disgrace, and that is what then this man, Jeremy Dibble, has been complaining about in the last week. Now, you may or may not agree with him. You may think that it's a national disgrace to have a £20 note that doesn't have a picture of Edward Elgar on it, or you may not. But one thing we can be certain about is that for first century Jews, it was a national disgrace to have a picture of the Roman Emperor, to have a picture of Caesar on their money, on their coins. And in fact, that disgrace, the national disgrace, paled into insignificance alongside another disgrace, the religious disgrace. Because not only was there a picture on those Roman coins, there was also an inscription, there was some writing. And the inscription on that on those coins, on those denariuses, on one side would have been this: Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. And then on the other side, the inscription would have been Pontifex Maximus, which meant something like high priest. And so you can imagine for those first century Jews, that inscription, both sides of the coin, would have been utterly blasphemous. Not merely a national disgrace, but a religious disgrace, because it was simply parading the Caesar's claim to deity, Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus, and his claim to be the primary religious person in the land, the Pontifex Maximus. And imagine then this scene here in Luke 20. Imagine Jesus taking this denarius and holding it up before his audience. And at least the few rows of people, the people nearest to him, they at least would have been able to see these blasphemous words. And imagine just how horrified they'd have been. They'd have shielded their eyes. They'd have been disgusted. It would have made their blood boil as Jesus held up this coin. And I'm saying then that the reason that Jesus did this, the reason that Jesus engaged in this piece of drama, was to really underline and to really highlight and to really emphasize what I said a moment ago, that God's people are to give to the state, are to fulfill their obligations to the state, regardless of the religious stance and the moral tone of that state. Here was this state that Jesus was inhabiting. Here was this Roman Empire, and the Caesar was claiming to be divine. He was claiming to be deity. He was claiming to be God. He was claiming to be the great high priest of all his people. You couldn't get more blasphemous and more offensive than that. Surely, if there was any occasion when it would be right to withhold respect and withhold honor and withhold taxes from the government, it would be in that context. And yet here's Jesus holding up this evidence of what a hideous and abhorrent regime that Roman regime was. And even as he does so, he's saying, give to Caesar. Give to Caesar your taxes. In April of this year, Dr. Albert Muller, who is an American preacher and writer and broadcaster, he wrote an article, and I'm just going to read a little bit of it to you. He says this, and of course he's speaking from an American perspective. He says, a significant number of Christians, that is Christians in America, are now wondering about the moral implications of the Obama healthcare overhaul. While any number of moral questions will demand attention, the question of abortion stands at the centre of concern. And with the question of abortion comes the question of taxes. It is almost certain, he continues, that the new healthcare legislation will lead to tax-supported abortions. At the very least, the legislation will lead to either direct or indirect taxpayer-supported subsidies for some abortions. At the extreme, it could mean outright coverage of abortion services. So should Christians defy the government and refuse to pay taxes if some involvement in abortion is almost certain? The answer to that question reaches far beyond the issue of abortion and far beyond the question of taxation. The answer to that question must be no. And he then goes on to look at the biblical evidence in Romans 13 and here in this passage. And then he concludes in this way. He says, abortion is a moral catastrophe. The number of the unborn is one of the greatest sins any society can tolerate, much less subsidized by taxation. The impact of the new Obamacare healthcare legislation is not yet fully clear, but the legislation lacks any adequate protection for the unborn. Immorality is added to immorality when the power of the government to tax citizens is involved in such a catastrophe. For this reason, Christian citizens should be involved at every level in the political process, seeking to use legitimate means to establish full protection for the unborn and for all other vulnerable persons. But to refuse to pay taxes is to deny the legitimacy of the government itself. Even to Christians under the yoke of Rome, Jesus instructed the payment of taxes. And we ourselves then, and not in precisely the same situation, perhaps, as Albert Muller, but in a fairly similar situation. And we have a government whose policies and whose use, perhaps, of our public money may often offend us and horrify us. And yet, Jesus was saying here, and he was saying through this piece of drama, holding up that offensive coin, He was saying, regardless of the abhorrence of the government, regardless of the obnoxiousness of the state, you must live as responsible citizens. You must pay taxes. You must give to Caesar what is Caesar's. So this response, then, it demonstrates brilliant rhetoric, it demonstrates brilliant balance, it demonstrates brilliant drama, but fourthly and finally, it demonstrates brilliant theology. Because we haven't touched then, have we, on the last part of Jesus' words in verse 25. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Is Jesus simply trying to finish off the phrase in a nice way? Is it really a bit empty and a bit vacuous, the last part? Or is there in fact some meaning to it? Well, I think that there is great meaning to it. I think, as I say, that it's brilliant theology. You see, Jesus, I think, is saying there in that last part. He's saying that there is, as we just sang in Psalm 47, there is an emperor who is infinitely more authoritative and more important than the Roman emperor. There is a real emperor. There is an ultimate emperor. God himself, who rules over the entire universe. And Jesus is saying that just as the little emperor Caesar, just as he has left his portrait, his image, scattered around on these little coins, on these denariuses, so the real emperor, so the true emperor, has also left his image scattered around. Because you see, I think Jesus here is alluding to a famous Old Testament verse. I think he's alluding to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. God's words there. Let us make man, what? In our image. And Jesus is alluding to that. And he's saying, look, God, the true emperor, has also left his portrait, his image, scattered around. But scattered not on pathetic little pieces of metal that jangle around in your pocket. He has left his image stamped upon our very humanness, upon the very fabric of our human beings, indicating that in his case, it's not simply money that he has the right to claim, but in his case, he has the right to claim human beings themselves. He has the right to us. He has the right to his human creatures. And I just want to close then with that challenge. You see, many of us in this room this morning are Christians. Perhaps you're not a Christian this morning. And perhaps you're under the impression that the reason that the people sitting around you are Christians is because they have found that that really fulfills them, it satisfies them, it floats their boats, it meets a particular need in their life, and so that's fine. You've got tennis. You've got reading novels, you've got music, whatever your thing might be, you've got that, they've got Christian religion, that's fine. And we need to recognise, you see, that that is not the reason why many of us this morning are Christians. It's not simply because we have found that God does it for us, that God fills that hole. It's rather because we have come to discover that God has a right to us. God has an objective right to our allegiance, to our loyalty, to our obedience, because he has made us and has left his image stamped upon us. And whoever you are this morning, wherever you come from, whatever kind of life you've lived, you too have the image of God stamped upon you. And yes, it's an important thing to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, to give back to the government the coins which are theirs, to give our taxes. That's important, that's serious. But what is infinitely more important and more serious is that we give to God ourselves, stamped as we are with his portraits. And we do that, of course, by coming to him through Jesus Christ, by coming through faith in Jesus Christ and saying, as we sang earlier on, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Have you done that? Amen. to close with a hymn that leads us appropriately into the Lord's Supper. Hymn number 442, Jesus calls us to his table as he did before he died.